Case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Asarco Incorporated against Idaho. I think you may proceed whenever you're ready now.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. The taxpayer appellant in this state income tax case is Asarco, a New Jersey company which has its corporate headquarters in New York. Asarco's business consists of mining, smelting, and refining copper and various other metals at locations throughout the United States. Its principal activity in Idaho is the operation of a silver mine. Because all of Asarco's mining and processing operations are closely integrated in a functional sense, everyone agrees that it's appropriate for Idaho to apply its three-factor apportionment formula to Asarco's total operating income in order to determine what portion of that income is properly attributable to the Idaho activities and therefore subject to Idaho tax. Their total business income from the coordinated operation of their mining, smelting, and refining operations in the United States. The issue here is whether Idaho can apply the same apportionment formula to dividends, interest, and capital gains that Asarco received from investments in five other companies which conducted all of their operations totally outside Idaho.
Doing what kind of business?
Three of them were in the mining business comparable to Asarco's. The other two were metal fabricators who did no mining themselves but simply manufactured metal products.
Would it be any different if they, in your view, if they had a chain of hotels and a chain of
I think there's no question, Your Honor, at all, that if Asarco operated a chain of hotels, either as a division of Asarco or as a separately incorporated subsidiary that was wholly owned by Asarco, that Idaho would be constitutionally barred by the Due Process Clause from taxing any of the income from the hotel operations, whether paid to Asarco as a share of divisional profits or as a dividend from a separately incorporated subsidiary. The reason for that is, I think, clear from this Court's prior decisions. Absent functional integration at the operational level, there is no basis for combining the income of two distinct operations and treating them as though it were one unitary business which earned its income as a whole.
Unless they had a hotel in Idaho.
I'm assuming, Your Honor, that the hotel operations are conducted entirely outside Idaho. I think this point was first established in a dictum in the Adams Express case years ago when this Court posited exactly the type of question that the Chief Justice just raised and assumed that a single party owned two separate and distinct operations in different states, despite the fact that those operations were wholly owned by the same party so that there was complete common control. This Court indicated that there would be no basis for treating them as parts of a unitary operation precisely because they were separate and distinct at the operational level. I think the same point came out very clearly in the dialogue between Justice Stevens and Mr. Dexter of the MTC during the Mobile oral argument several years ago when you posited the case very similar to the Chief Justice's of a toy operation being conducted by Mobile as a division totally outside Vermont, the taxing state in that case. And I think Mr. Dexter properly recognized that Vermont would be constitutionally barred from taxing any portion of the profits generated by the toy business in that type of situation precisely because there is no functional integration that would call into question the accounting for the separate and distinct operations.
That's whether it was operated as a division or as a sub.
Yes, I think that Justice Blackmun's opinion in Mobile makes it absolutely clear that the focal point for the inquiry ought to be the economic realities and not the legal form of doing business. Specifically, what the court said in Mobile was that the legal distinction between a subsidiary and a division doesn't affect the economic realities and ought not to affect the apportionability of the income the parent receives. And so,
on that subject, let me ask you, Mr. Beatty. Now, I suppose as to the short-term interest earnings that ASARCO might have in the money market or short-term securities to maintain cash needs, you concede that that can be taxable.
We do. That, it seems to us, is clearly income earned from ASARCO's regular business activities. It's employing its working capital on a short-term basis.
Now, what if it places it on a little longer-term basis, then? What's
I think
the
if
difference?
It, if it places it in permanent investments, in sizable stock investments, or in debentures, which are involved here to an extent, that type of permanent investment becomes disassociated from the normal operating.
But it's kind of hard to draw the line, isn't it? Some of these investments are for longer periods and some for shorter, and all of a sudden you have a stock acquisition. How do you reasonably draw the line?
I think, as in all instances that basically involve factual determinations, that you've got to do it gradually on a case-by-case basis as you see appropriate factual situations developing. I think there is a clear difference between a very short-term investment, which we're not contesting here, and a permanent long-term investment that's held for many years, as the investments here were. Precisely where the dividing line should be drawn, whether it should be at a 5-year, 10-year, or some other stated maturity term, I don't frankly know, but I think...
Well, what standard are we to lay down constitutionally then to make the distinction?
The basic issue, it seems to me, in these cases, is not the treatment of the interest income, but rather the treatment of the dividend income flowing from investments in major operating companies. And there, I think it's clear that the test that you ought to apply is the one suggested in Mobile, Justice Brennan, and that is, are the underlying operations that generate the income used to pay the dividends functionally related with the business activities of the recipient, so that it's impossible to unscramble the business and break it into separate component parts? If so, then it's a unitary business and the dividends ought to be apportioned along with all the other income of the unitary business.
Without otherwise affecting the...
Certainly not. If
formula?
If the dividends are going to be treated as apportionable income, then I think it's absolutely essential that the property, payroll, and sales that generated that income be taken into account in the apportionment factors.
All of them?
All of them.
So you think there are only two categories in this business. They're either unitary or not.
I think that's correct. It seems to me that if the operations are going to be treated as unitary and the income is going to be apportioned, Justice White, that it's essential in order to get true apportionment to reflect all of the factors associated with the earning of that income.
So no dividend income can be taken into account unless the denominator changes to...
Let me indicate our recognition of conceivable exceptions to that rule. We noted in our brief the possibility that ownership of stock could be a necessary part of the taxpayer's business in the sense that applying the functional standards of mobile, the ownership is an indispensable adjunct to the conduct of the business, as it would be clearly if the taxpayer holding the stock investments that produce the income were a securities dealer whose business was the buying and selling of stocks. Another possible example would be that of a contractor who has to post bond in order to bid and perform on jobs, and for that purpose maintains a portfolio of investment securities, be they debt or equity securities, that he can use to fulfill his bonding obligations. There, the ownership of the stock and securities is clearly an adjunct to the actual conduct of the taxpayer's own business. And in that type of situation, I think the proper application of mobile is to look at the functional relationship between the ownership of those securities and the conduct of the taxpayer's business. But nothing of that sort is involved here.
Well, what if ASARCO, in order to develop some sources for materials, wants to get some copper out of some foreign country? It finds out that in order to do it, it has to form a domestic corporation, domestic in that other country, and it can only buy 48% of it. If it wants any of that copper, that's the way it has to do business. Now, is that one of your exceptions or not?
We have several situations here, and I think it might be helpful to deal with the facts of those situations, because one of the dividend-paying companies here, Southern Peru, comes approximately into the range that describing.
Are you going to address that?
I will indeed. Yes. Let me describe the two polar cases that we see presented here. The first is MIM's situation. The record shows that MIM is a publicly held mining company operating in Australia and England.
Mr. Beatty,
yes.
Does the record show why ASARCO acquired its interest in MIM?
It does not.
Here it owns 53.
It's simply described as a long-term investment.
53% of it.
We own 53%.
I suppose you know, but if it isn't in the record, I won't ask.
The operations of MIM, as I said, are conducted entirely in Australia and England. The State District Court made an undisputed finding that those operations were carried on entirely independently of ASARCO. There were virtually no intercompany transactions between the two companies, and there were no common officers or directors.
Well, there's an intimation in the other briefs that economic realities were the cause of this. Do you agree with that?
There was testimony at trial to the effect that ASARCO decided not to exercise its controlling stock interest in order to elect the board of directors or the officers of MIM, because MIM was performing admirably on its own. It was a separate, freestanding enterprise run and managed by Australians. I think that our capacity, theoretically, to control should not be controlling. What ought to be controlling is the actual undisputed facts, and there is no dispute about the fact that ASARCO played no role whatsoever in the management or the operation of MIM's mining and smelting activities in Australia and England.
To my question, it was in response, I thought, to your statement that there were practically no intercompany transactions with MIM. And I was concerned. I thought there was an inference in the other briefs that this was because of economic realities.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood
and
the
I'd
question.
I'd like to comment on that.
There was an indication that because of the distance between Australia and the United States, it would have been uneconomic in most instances to ship ores and concentrates from Australia to the United States. But I think it's immaterial why there were no intercompany transactions. The important fact is that there were none.
Well, you think it would make a difference if ASARCO had exercised its control and elected all members of the board?
By simply electing board members, Justice White, I don't think ASARCO should have changed the result here. To me, it would be significant only if there were an indication that the management of the working operations was being dictated by ASARCO. Any major stock investment is going to involve participation by the investor in an oversight manner.
Assume that ASARCO did manage it intimately, ran the day-to-day operations. Why would that make it different from a hotel company in which they ran the day-to-day operations?
I don't think that participation in management in and of itself would be significant, Justice Stevens. I think it would begin to point in the direction of functional integration and would perhaps call for a closer inquiry.
Would that be because you're allocating part of the central office expense
yes.
of the management?
Is that yes.
what it would be? But why wouldn't that be true of a hotel company, too?
To the extent that there is overlapping centralized management so that the hotel company benefits in some way from the operations of the mining company or vice versa, you start to approach the functional integration that was involved in the Exxon case. But you only start to approach it again, I think, as I indicated to Justice O'Connor, all of these questions are ones of degree.
Do you think, Mr. Petty, our cases have laid down any criteria by which one determines functional integration?
I think you've certainly suggested it in the
sense that
every case...
Have we listed them?
No, you haven't.
Have you any suggestions what they ought to be?
I think basically you need to look at three factors, Justice Brennan. Ownership of the different enterprises is clearly necessary but not sufficient. Unless there is a substantial degree of common ownership, clearly there's no basis for finding a unitary business simply because of transactions between the various elements of the activity that you're looking at. As I indicated earlier, though, 100% common ownership, I don't think is sufficient to create a unitary business. You've got to go beyond that. The second factor that I think should be looked at is the management aspect. And by that, I'm not referring to board of directors supervision of a stewardship nature. I'm referring to management participation at an operational level.
In other words, ASARCO's management has to participate at the operational level of the subsidiary before you have functional integration.
I think so, yes.
What you're saying.
But again, I don't think that's sufficient. The third and most important criteria that I think you have to look at is the degree to which the various business activities involved are interrelated in some sort of functional, working, or operational sense. Mobil's and Exxon's cases presented, I think, clear examples of that. In each instance, you were looking at a vertically integrated petroleum enterprise that performed all of the functions from exploration to drilling to production to refining to marketing of the end product. And
but
clearly,
it wouldn't be enough that both are copper mines.
No, the fact that both are engaged in the same line of business doesn't to us mean that there's any functional integration. It simply means that there are two parallel lines of business which may never intersect, and in the case of MIM, virtually never did intersect. Your earlier decisions, I think, reflect this same emphasis on functional integration. If we go back to the early apportionment cases, Underwood Typewriter and Bass Ratcliffe and Moorman and Northwestern State Cement, all of those cases involved situations where a common owner was manufacturing a product in one jurisdiction and selling it in another. And clearly, that's the classic example of a unitary business that earns its income as a whole. The manufacturing portion of the enterprise obviously can't earn any income until its products have been sold by the marketing organization.
So that if you had both in the copper business and the subsidiary's product was marketed to customers of the parent, that would be enough?
That is certainly a normal indication of a unitary business. Yes, it's conceivable that you might have exceptions.
But if it's all marketed in England and never sees any customer in the United States, so the parent ever gets to it, then there's no functional integration.
I'm not necessarily suggesting that geographical boundary lines determine the extent of a functionally related business. In Bass Ratcliffe, in fact, ale manufactured in Great Britain was sold in New York by the same company, and you, I think, properly treated that as one unitary business. Obviously, as you pointed out there, the manufacturing arm earned no income until the product was sold, and it's equally clear that the sales organization could have earned no income unless it had a manufactured product to sell. So that is the classic type of functional integration.
Now you're going to get to another polar case, I guess.
The other case that we do need to deal with is Southern Peru, which is at the opposite end of the spectrum from MIM in the array of individual situations presented to you here, because we admittedly did have substantial business dealings with Southern Peru, and it was a source of supply to ASARCO. The important factors, though, I think, are that ASARCO is the major custom smelter of copper in the United States. The record shows that at that time it handled roughly 80% of the custom smelting business in this country. ASARCO had numerous supply contracts with many other unrelated parties who sold copper ores and concentrates to ASARCO under long-term contracts comparable to those which ASARCO had with Southern Peru. There was testimony establishing that the prices charged under those contracts were the same as the prices paid to Southern Peru. Under those circumstances, it seems clear to us that ASARCO's unrelated suppliers can't be viewed as part of ASARCO's unitary business. Why should the result be any different in the case of Southern Peru?
What if one of ASARCO's smelters had been in Idaho? What if one of ASARCO's smelters had been in Idaho?
We are recognizing, Justice Rehnquist, that all of ASARCO's mining, smelting, and refining activities in the United States are one unitary business. That's our business that's comparable to Exxon's business. We have included all of our operations from exploration through sale of the refined product in the apportionable income which has been taxed in Idaho and all of the other jurisdictions where we operate. What we are trying to carve out from the apportionable income is the dividend income which ASARCO received from independently operated and managed affiliates and subsidiaries operating overseas, and also the income received from customers, General Cable and Revere, in which we had an ownership interest.
So it would have made no difference then even if all the smelters had been located?
None whatsoever.
Mr. Beatty, would you concede that any state can include this income for tax purposes, the domiciliary state, for example?
I think that the domiciliary state can take no more than its fair share of apportionable income.
It's your position that the domiciliary state can't include it all?
Whatever may not be properly apportioned to the non-domiciliary states may be properly available to the domiciliary state under the Due Process Clause. Under the Foreign Commerce Clause, which we've discussed in our brief, there may be additional problems with the domiciliary state taxing. If I could, I'd like to briefly turn to the alternative issue that's raised by this case involving...
Are you finished with Peru? You just say, well, why should it be any different than...
I was trying to suggest that our relationships with southern Peru, Justice White, were no different from the relationships which we had with many other totally unrelated suppliers of ores and concentrates, all of whom are admittedly not part
of
our
business.
Well, except
you own, how much do you own of southern Peru?
We own 51.5%.
51, and you have the power to control it, I suppose.
We have the power to control, but there is...
Do you?
...clear testimony in the record establishing that ASARCO does not control southern Peru by virtue of bylaws...
Well, one of your factors is present here that isn't... That isn't true with the other.
That is absolutely correct, and we recognize that southern Peru is not as strong a case from our standpoint as MIM for that precise reason. But I don't think that it reaches the point of functional integration or unity that is involved in a situation like Exxon's, where a wholly owned enterprise was being conducted in a way that maximized operating efficiency.
Well, I suppose you would say, Mr. Brady, that even if the third criterion is met, the second is not. In the case of southern Peru.
Correct, although we have the capacity to manage, and although ASARCO's officers...
But you don't, in fact.
ASARCO's officers do, in fact, serve in some years as officers of southern Peru. We cannot unilaterally control southern Peru by virtue of this bylaw structure that ensures that the other shareholders collectively can outvote us.
Would your claim on southern Peru be equally strong if southern Peru were, in fact, in southern Florida?
I think it would be the same issue.
And I take it then if ASARCO bought a different metal mine in Utah and sold all of the product from that mine to a Utah smelter, and it was completely different metal. You just bought the mine. You were in the mining business, but none of that metal ever came to Idaho. That would be an MIM case.
No, I doubt that, because our domestic operations are so functionally integrated, Justice White, that we would, I think, have to recognize that the...
Well, there just never be any transactions between the two companies.
Perhaps we have been unduly generous to Idaho and the other states in the reaction that we've pursued thus far, but we have not challenged the idea that all of our domestic metals operations are unitary. We operate only a silver mine in Idaho. As we indicated in our brief, we could have taken the position that all of our operations involving copper should be totally excluded from any apportionment formula that Idaho applies. Let me, if I could, turn just briefly to the alternative questions relating to adjustment of the apportionment factor. The state urges that no adjustment be made because the income that we're receiving is income from intangibles, and that somehow those intangibles should be viewed as being owned everywhere where our domestic business is being conducted. That's not the economic realities of this case at all. The economic realities are that the income in question was generated by the property, payroll, and sales of Mount Isa and Southern Peru and General Cable. The stipulated record shows that the five dividend-paying companies had aggregate sales in each year of over $1,100,000,000. Idaho didn't take into account 1 cent of that money in its apportionment formula. The record shows that the five dividend-paying companies owned smelters, refineries, mines, seaports, a whole host of property values, none of which Idaho took into account.
But you're saying they have to take all of it into account.
They should take into account, we believe, a pro rata portion.
Oh, so not
equivalent
all.
To the pro rata portion of the earnings of the enterprise that flow to a startup.
Because otherwise you would have to take into account all of the gross income, all of the net income.
Yeah, we're talking here, the state has conceded in its brief that these operations are not unitary, and it's conceded that a combined report of the sort you'll hear about this afternoon would be inappropriate. We're talking only about the income that was actually received. The question is,
pro rata share.
What property, payroll, and sales properly belongs to that pro rata share? I'd like to reserve my remaining time, if I could, for rebuttal.
Mr. Spangler?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, Idaho's position in this case is really quite simple and very fundamental, and we think entirely consistent with the previous decisions of this Court. That is that when intangible assets, such as, for example, shares of stock, are found to be a part of a taxpayer's own unitary business, that is, when they, the intangibles, contribute to or relate to or are some way in furtherance of the taxpayer's own trade or business, there is no logical or constitutional reason why the income from those same intangibles should be treated any differently than any other business income that that taxpayer might earn.
How about the income from the hotel chain, or the dividends from the hotel chain?
Mr. Justice, I might answer that question by pointing out that the Idaho Supreme Court in this case did not permit apportionment of dividends from a company that was engaged in asbestos mining in Canada. What the Idaho court found there was that the intangible asset was not held for purposes that were specifically related to or in furtherance of this unitary business that ASARCO admittedly conducts partly in the state of Idaho. The issue for due process purposes, we think, is whether or not the intangible asset itself, like any other asset that the taxpayer may own, is held for purposes relating to or in furtherance of that unitary business.
And I'm sorry, Mr. Attorney General, how did the your Supreme Court distinguish the asbestos from what we have here?
What they said, sir, was that these particular asbestos companies, that the shares of stock in those asbestos companies, that ASARCO had clearly and convincingly and cogently segregated by showing that those intangible assets...
Was there record evidence on this question?
Yes, sir. There was record evidence. There was testimony, and the Idaho court said that because they had shown a complete lack of relationship between the asset, the intangible asset, the shares of stock, and their mining, smelting, and refining of non-ferrous metals activities that they conducted in the United States, that those were not apportionable. And that, I think, is responsive probably to the...
Whereas there's contrary findings as to the... affiliates and subsidiaries we have here. Is
that precisely, sir. In regard to the five corporations at issue here, the Idaho court specifically said that ASARCO had acquired and maintained its ownership interest in these companies as an integral and necessary part of its mining and smelting business.
Again, based on record evidence?
Yes, sir.
Had those findings been made by your trial court as well?
At the trial court level, the trial judge had concluded to the contrary in regard to these particular subsidiaries, and what the Idaho court said was that in regard to these particular subsidiaries, the trial court's conclusion was not consistent with the evidence that was in the record.
Well, do you think the standard you're urging on us here is the same as the Idaho court applied?
Yes, sir, I do.
You mean in furtherance of?
The language of the Uniform Act, the Uniform Division of Income for Tax Purposes Act, which is really the constitutionality of which is really at issue here, the statutory standard that the Idaho court followed was this income from tangible or intangible property acquired, managed, or disposed of in the regular course of the taxpayer's trade or business? And that's before they ever got to the constitutional issue, the Idaho court had to conclude under that uniform statute standard that the intangible assets were related to and in furtherance of the unitary business activity.
Why?
And,
why?
Clearly because...
Those words aren't in the Uniform Act.
What, the acquisition, management, and disposition?
No, the related to or furtherance of.
No, those words are not, but that they are an integral
those are
and necessary
you're,
part.
That's the standard you're urging on us. Now, did the Idaho court apply that standard or not?
Well, I think I'm intending to use those words with virtually the same meaning. That is, that they are...
Well, why don't you use the Idaho court's words?
The Idaho court's words were the statutory words, which were are an integral
well,
and necessary
part of...
Why
don't you use them?
Yes, sir, I will.
Well, you don't. I just wondered why you don't.
I guess because I didn't perceive a constitutional difference between those. The if they are
I'm
an
not
integral...
I'm sure there is, but it just sounds like a different standard.
Yes, sir. If they are an integral and necessary part in the statutory language of the taxpayer's trade or business. Here, for example, you've heard of southern Peru being a source of raw materials, copper concentrates, for the smelters that were part of the unitary business in the United States. Other companies were under the record, quote, major customers of ASARCO.
Well, on that customer point, directing your attention to General Cable, which I understand was partially owned and then sold, and as I understand, the business relationship continued to be the same before and after the sale. Is that correct? Was it necessary part of the integrated business at one time and not at another time, or at both times, or at neither?
No, the we don't see that the continuing customer-supplier relationship before and after the sale is necessarily relevant. What we think was that that ASARCO did not, and the Idaho court properly concluded, did not show that the shares of stock were unrelated to the business activity. I think there's a couple of things that are sort of getting confused here. One of the prior questions was, are there two things here? Are there just unitary and not unitary? And we don't think there are just two things here. We think there are three things. That is, you have this situation like with the asbestos companies, where the shares, the companies are not functionally integrated with the taxpayer, nor are the shares of stock held for purposes related to the business activities. You then have, on the other end of the spectrum, and there were six subsidiaries with ASARCO that were held to be so functionally integrated, so interdependent in their business operations, that they should be included in a combined report, with the result that all of the income was in the apportionable base, the dividends were eliminated, and the property, payroll, and sales of all six were included in the apportionment formula. That's the issue that you'll have later this afternoon in the Chicago Bridge and Iron v. Caterpillar case. This is really the third case. This is the case where the payor and the payee corporations are not so functionally integrated that they are together conducting one single unitary business operation. But the shares of stock, the assets, are held for purposes that are an integral and necessary part of that unitary
business. May I ask, to be sure we have it clearly understood, do you concede that this intermediate category is not part of the unitary business?
We have conceded, or we have not asserted, that those subsidiary corporations are themselves together engaged with ASARCO in one unitary business. We do
have
not
you conceded that they are not part of the unitary business?
The companies themselves are not. The intangible asset.
But the income from the companies is what you say is the only part of the unitary business.
The intangible asset and the income earned from the intangible
then
asset.
Explain to me, how does that income either increase or decrease the profitability of the Idaho operations? That's ultimately what we're searching for, is the earnings
because
of the Idaho operations.
Because the Idaho operations are part of this overall unitary business, and we're apportioning unitary income, what we're looking to is those activities that relate to the entire unitary income.
But you're only looking to out-of-state activities insofar as they affect the profitability of the in-state activities. Is that not true?
But yes, sir. But because the in-state activities are part of this inseparable unitary business.
But we're talking about now a group of companies that are not, as I understand your concession, part of the unitary business.
Yes, sir. But the point I seem not to be getting across is that we don't see that there is a different due process standard for different kinds or classes of income. The due process standard is first Is there a nexus?
Well, is it not clear that the purpose, the entire purpose of the due process standard is to measure the profitability of the in-state operations?
Well, yes, sir.
And unless it affects the profitability of the in-state operations, you're constitutionally prohibited from taxing out-of-state income.
Yes, sir. And our point is that it does affect the profitability of the in-state operation because that in-state operation is part of this inseparable unitary business, and these intangible assets, as distinguished from the corporations, the other corporations themselves, are also part of that inseparable unitary business. And because intangibles, by their very nature, have no particular geographic source, and when they relate to where to every place where the business activity occurs, that it's entirely reasonable and constitutional to say that all of the states where that unitary business activity occurs have a constitutional right to tax a fairly apportioned share of that income.
Well, that, on that basis, your integral and necessary part standard goes right out the window. You just say if the unitary business, as you define it, excluding these companies, has any kind of income whatsoever, whether it comes from an intangible asset that is an integral necessary part or not, is to be taken into account.
No, sir. If they are part of the intangible asset being an integral and necessary part...
Well, give me an example of some income of this unitary business that you wouldn't want to apportion. I don't understand why you would agree to the asbestos set-aside.
Well, the question there, of course, was a question...
That's certainly, they owned a business in Canada.
And it's a mining business.
And it's income, and you get dividends from it.
Yes,
sir. So how do you put that aside?
The issue there is an issue of fact. They were mining businesses, they did own it, but the record that was established was related to things like the technological differences in regard to asbestos as opposed to others, and the lack of any relationship or contribution of the asbestos company, very much like a motel chain.
Well, income. Income to the unitary business.
No. Income from activities. The activities that are relevant are the, in using the statutory standard, the management, acquisition, and disposition of intangible properties. That is, ASARCO is not mining in Canada or mining in southern Peru. That is, that's not the activity. Excuse me. That's
but
not the
but
activity.
But you're conceding that it's income from operations that are not a part of the unitary business.
No, sir. That's not what I'm conceding. What I am conceding
is... I misunderstood you earlier.
What I am conceding is that the...
Let me ask again. Are these intermediate companies part or not part of the unitary business?
The payor corporations.
The payor corporations.
Not been found to be part of the unitary business.
They are not. Now, how does income from those corporations differ from income from the asbestos company?
Because we're failing to...
They're both paid to the unitary business.
We're failing to distinguish that the income is ASARCO's income not from mining in southern Peru, but from its acquisition, management, and disposition of these shares of stock, which...
And how are they different from acquisition, management, and shares of stock in a hotel company or the asbestos company?
Because if they did own stock in the hotel company, there would be no relationship with the mining business. That is, that intangible asset would be unrelated to the mining business. This intangible asset, the shares of stock in the mining company that provided them a guaranteed source of supply, is related to this unitary business, part of which is conducted in the state of Idaho.
Well, just being related then satisfies the integral and necessary part standard. Just being related. As long as your intangible relates to the mining business, ipso facto, an integral and necessary part.
Well, sir, I guess I keep falling in that same... In that same trap, I do think that the statutory...
Well, it isn't a trap. I'm trying to figure out what your standard is.
Well, my standard, Your Honor, or the standard of the Idaho was the standard of the Idaho court. It was a statutory language. The intangible asset has to be an integral and necessary part of the taxpayer's regular unitary business activities. That...
Well, now you tell us all you have to do to satisfy that is to have some relationship.
I suppose not any relationship.
That's the way you distinguish the hotel business. You say it just doesn't have any relationship to the mining business.
It is not an integral and necessary part of the mining business. It makes no contribution, does not act in furtherance of the mining business. Here, the intangible assets did make contributions, or they were in furtherance of. They were, or at least ASARCO had failed to show that in the...
What about asbestos in Canada?
The